It's Karen Conti here. I've been a practicing lawyer in Chicago for 30 years. I try cases, I settle disputes, and as you know, this is the time where I answer your legal questions from 8 to 9. Give me a call here at 312-981-7200. I'll try to answer all the questions that you have, employment, family law, estate planning, criminal matters. You ask it, I'll try to give you an answer. 312-981-7200. But what I want to do first is I have a guest tonight, and I'd like to talk to David Zahner. David Zahner is a trial consultant with Zahner Trial Consulting for over 20 years. He's been instrumental in consulting with lawyers to help them win their cases in court. He's consulted over 800 cases, 40 states, 180 venues in all areas of the law. Welcome, David.
Hi, Karen. It's a pleasure to be on tonight.
Jury consultants. What do jury consultants do? I mean, I know they help pick jurors, but what else do they do in helping lawyers prepare their cases?
Yeah, the biggest misconception about what jury consultants do, other than what they think we do based on bull,
people think it's like hocus pocus, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Or they think that we spend most of our time in courtrooms picking jurors. And actually, the opposite is true. We spend most of our times with people who are kind of like the jurors in juror research exercises where we simulate what kind of information they're going to hear in the case. We listen to what they have to say about it. And from that, we help the lawyers develop the themes and evidence that's going to be most persuasive in persuading jurors at trial.
Okay. Now, obviously, you do all different kinds of cases. You have criminal cases, you have civil cases, you work on defense, you work as a plaintiff. Is there a different type of strategy that you use in each case, or is it kind of the same thing each time?
No, every case is different. While there are some similarities between the cases, for every case you have to develop a strategy based on the evidence you have in that case, on the strengths and weaknesses in your case, and the strengths and weaknesses on the other side. And you're always looking for a way to develop a couple of edges and things that you can get the jurors to do to understand what is the best point of your case and to make that the way they decide the case.
I'd like to go through a few examples of some cases maybe that we're aware of because they're in the news. But first, I kind of want to ask you, is it true that jurors really make their mind up very quickly? I've heard that, you know, and I've tried hundreds of cases myself, and I'm usually the one who gives the opening statement. And I hear that, you know, maybe even at the point of jury selection, the case is done, but certainly by the time your opening statement is done, the jurors have largely really made up their minds. Is that true?
For the most part, it is. It is frightening for lawyers when we do these exercises and they find out, wait, the jurors heard a two-sentence description of the case, and a lot of them have already made up their mind. An interesting thing that people, in order to make complex decisions that they know nothing about, and most jurors, when they come into a courtroom, don't know anything about the underlying legal theories of a case. And so they are looking for a cognitive shortcut that they can use to understand. And so when they hear a case, for example, about a car accident or about a dispute in the workplace, they are looking for a quick heuristic or schema through which they can interpret the rest of the evidence. And if they pick that heuristic right away, they find out, they filter all the information they receive, and they don't listen to the other information that doesn't fit into that pre-existing schema. And therefore, it's very hard to change jurors' minds once they've decided how a case should go.
And obviously, we have a process where we select jurors, and it's called voir dire, and it's a process where lawyers can ask questions of the potential jurors and ask them all kinds of questions about what their beliefs are, maybe even about what their political beliefs are, where they're from, have they ever been involved in litigation, and the like. And are those questions really effective in winnowing out people who might not be sympathetic to your particular case?
Yeah, if done properly, you can do an excellent job of finding the people who have pre-existing biases or pre-existing experiences in their life that make them predisposed to be against your case. Now, remember, we're not saying that people are intentionally trying to be biased in one way or other. There's very little people can do, though, that the attitudes and experiences that have shaped their lives are going to influence how they view the evidence. And what we try and do is develop questions that will help identify the people who, for no fault of their own, have had things happen to them in their lives or have certain attitudes or experiences that make them biased against you. They won't listen to the evidence that you're presenting because they can't. Their brains are already shut off in those areas.
Interesting. We're talking to David Zahner, who is the founder of Zahner Trial Consulting, doing jury consulting. We're still going to take legal calls, so please call in 312-981-7200, and we'll get to your calls in a few minutes. David, I want to talk about a case that's been in the news for the last couple of weeks. Actually, a good friend of mine is the plaintiff's lawyer on the case, and I did change some emails with him. It's the case where a 26-year-old woman was paralyzed when a bus shelter fell on her. She was a former dancer and was in very good shape and wanted to do dancing. And she was standing near O'Hare International Airport at one of those shelters. It was poorly maintained, and the thing fell on her, and she was horribly paralyzed and horribly injured with all kinds of pain. Apparently, there was a $22 million offer by the city of Chicago, which has been rejected. So given this case is going on right now, $22 million, wow, that's an offer that someone has rejected. That's an amazing amount of money to reject, right? How would you, if you were the plaintiff's lawyer, what kind of people would you want on this jury who you expect or you demand will give the plaintiff much more than that?
Yeah, actually, I mean, the most important part for the plaintiffs, and we pick a lot of cases for plaintiffs in Cook County, the people you are looking for are the people you're going to exclude. And the people they need to exclude are the people who, for whatever reason, have a cap on the amount of money that they can give. And there are lots of people for lots of different reasons who believe, well, I can't give more than $5 million, $10 million, $20 million. And I'm sure
they just have that in their head?
They have that in their head.
Huh.
And there's been lots of writing and a lot of times attempts to persuade people that this is a good thing to have. There's been all sorts of types of articles about, oh, why it is that jurors should give limited amounts of money, mainly being brought in by companies that don't like going to lawsuits and facing, for example, a $150 million offer when one of their stanchions falls on top of somebody. And so it's a very interesting dynamic that goes on. The main thing you're trying to do in jury selection is get people to be honest and say, look, if the evidence proves that it should be $150 million, would you be willing to give that? And a lot of people would say no. And those are the people, not only are you being excluding those people for what is called a peremptory challenge, which you can use on anyone, but you're going to ask the judge to exclude those people because they are saying you don't follow the law. And I don't know how many peremptory challenges, I don't know how many cause challenges that occurred in this case, but especially when the city of Chicago is a defendant, that is the best way a plaintiff can get a jury that's sympathetic to him is by extending the number of people who say, I can't be fair in this case. I'm going to favor the city of Chicago, for example, because I'm afraid my taxes are going to go up.
Right.
Or I'm going to I just have a limit of how much money I can give.
And I think what you have to understand in these types of cases is people say, why would someone need that much money? But if you really look at it, and the plaintiff's lawyers do a pretty good job of kind of extending, you know, into that person's life. If she lives to be 80 years old or whatever the life expectancy is, she's going to need a full-time caretaker probably at some point in her life when her parents are deceased. And she's going to need operations, and she's going to need therapy, and she's going to need a special place to live and someone to drive her around. And those things are expensive, and we don't know into the future how much that is going to cost. So, you know, when a juror is presented with that kind of evidence, sometimes they change their mind. But what you're telling me is sometimes they don't. They're just going to do what they want to do regardless of the evidence.
Right. And it's in a case like this, and I believe in this case, the city admitted liability, which means they're not contesting negligence. They're not contesting that they were the cause of the injuries.
Which might be a good strategy, right?
Actually a very smart strategy, yes, for them to do. I mean, in cases where the city has had problems before, they've been unwilling to do that, even when the evidence is overwhelming. Like in this case, I believe there were evidence that over 22 bolts were missing from the stanchion, and in other stanchions also. So that was a very smart strategic decision. And what that does is it limits the amount of anger jurors have in the case.
That's right, because they said I did it.
Right.
Interesting. But I'd probably have a verdict this week and maybe be talking about it next week. This is Karen Conti. I'm here with David Zanner talking about jury consulting. And I'm taking your calls after the break, 312-981-7200. You're listening to Chicago's very own 720 WGN. Karen Conti in here for Brian Noonan. You know, while the lakefront sounded like a war zone this weekend with the air and water show, The south and the west side of the city were, I think, actually a war zone. So, and I don't know if, about any of you who keep track of some of the murders that are going on. There's a website called heyjackass.com. I don't know why it's called that, but it gives you the up-to-date statistics on what shootings happened and what murders happened and where the areas that these things occurred. But this weekend so far, can you believe this? 40 wounded, 7 killed. That makes the total for the year. Total shot, 2,419. Total homicides, 457. I don't know. I don't know what the solution is, but I don't like it. Anyway, we're here and we're taking legal calls and we've got some people calling in. The phone lines are open, 312-981-7200. Let's go to Isaiah, who has been patiently waiting. Hi, Isaiah. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. What's your legal question?
Yeah, question. With the new format for calculation of child support, is that based on actual number of overnights or what's court-ordered in the parents' agreement or divorce decree?
Okay. Let me explain a little bit for everybody out there, so I'm going to back up. As of July 1st of this year, we have a new way of calculating child support. People who are out there who are getting child support or paying it, you may recall that when it was calculated, it was based upon your income, and there was a percentage. Like if it's one child, it'd be 20%. Two children, 28%. Now we have a very complicated formula for calculating it, which is based upon both parties' incomes. And it basically looks at how much each party is making, how many days and nights are spent with the children, and then it goes to reference what the actual cost of raising a child is in your income bracket. So it's not very simple to calculate as it used to be, but it is supposed to be more fair to the parties because it does consider actual costs of raising a child rather than some blanket amount. So your question to me is that your question was that could you ask me a question again?
Yeah, no worries. Basically, if it's court ordered to
yes,
be every
okay.
other weekend and the actual overnights
yes.
are once every, let's say, 2 or 3 months. How does that factor in the new calculation?
So the law says that there is a factor that you consider, I believe it's 146 nights. If you have the children for 146 nights, there's a different calculation that actually reduces your child support obligations. Now, we don't know the answer to your question, Isaiah, because we don't know how the judges are enforcing it. Your question is, let's just say there's a court order that says you get the children 130 days, but you're actually exercising visitation 160 days. Do you get that reduction because you're actually spending more time? And the answer is, I don't know how the judges are going to apply that. I don't know if they're going to take that into effect. But if that's something that you're concerned about, I would suggest that you keep track of how many nights you have the children. And when the time comes and you'd like to reduce your child support obligation, that factor might be something that you can bring to the court's attention. Just so you know, and I'm not saying one way or the other what is right or wrong, but this is really causing a lot of strain in relationships now when I'm getting people divorced because people want more time with their children sometimes, not always, because they want their child support obligation to be reduced. So they'll say, I want an extra 2 days a month because that'll put me over the edge. And that means my child support is basically divided in half. So it's very complicated. And Isaiah, I'm sorry I can't give you an answer because it's just too new. All right.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate the information.
All right. Take care. Let's go to Ed. Ed on the road. Hi, Ed. Ed on the road. Hi, it's Karen at WGN.
Hi, how are you doing this evening?
Doing well. Do you have a legal question, or are you going down to see the eclipse?
Yes, on both counts. I'm halfway from La Salle, Peru, down to Bloomington Normal, and I'm going to stay with a friend down there, but looking forward to the eclipse tomorrow.
Great.
But my question has to do with insurance company liability in an automobile accident and whether they can deny liability. I can give you the scenario if you like.
Yes, please do.
Okay, driving in my car and I stop on the interstate and somebody rear ends me. Obviously, there's nobody that pushed him into me. We were the only two cars involved. He was inattentive and bumped into me. Not a lot of damage, but there should be, there is some, and I'd like it fixed. But there was no police report made because let's say that their It was a minor accident, and there was minimal damage. But now when it presented to his insurance company, he claims that somebody pushed him into me, and the insurance company is saying because that person fled the scene, that they can deny liability. What would you opine on that?
Yeah, well, first of all, if someone rear-ends you, that person is always liable, because even if you, let's just say you put on the brakes and you probably did it in a way that was unsafe, still they had a last clear chance, we call it, to stop. They probably were going too fast. Otherwise, you know what, Ed, I'm going to put you on hold and have you listen just because there's a little bit of traffic noise, okay?
Sure. Okay. No, I appreciate that.
Okay. I think I just did that. Thank you. So there's going to be liability. Here's the problem. It sounds to me like the insurance carrier for the guy who rear-ended you is just denying coverage. And insurance companies come in all shapes and sizes. Some of them are excellent. Some of them are substandard, we call them. And they will deny liability based on absolutely, positively nothing. And this does not sound like a valid reason that someone else hit him and therefore there's no liability to you. That doesn't fly at all. That doesn't make any sense. The problem is you can't really go after that insurance carrier directly. In Illinois, you don't have a right to sue that insurance carrier. So let's just say that you wanted to pursue it. You would have to sue the driver, and the driver would either have to pay it himself or would have to get his substandard insurance carrier to cover it. And again, how much is it worth? If you have $500 in damages, is it worth doing that? Probably not. If you were injured, yes, it might be. It might be that you would sue the driver and he would convince his insurance carrier to step in and do the right thing. But unfortunately, like I said, there are a lot of substandard carriers out there. And I would urge everybody who has insurance, and you should all have insurance because you must, that you make sure that you have a good carrier, even though you pay less for a substandard carrier when the time comes and you get in trouble and you have an accident and they're not going to cover you. It's going to be a disaster, and it's worth it to pay a little bit extra. Hope that helps out. Let's just talk to David. David Zanner has been standing by. He's our trial consultant. We have just a few minutes before we go to break. I'm going to take some more calls after the news. But let me just talk. I wanted to spend a little time talking about how jury selection works. I use the term voir dire. Can you tell the jurors, could you tell the listeners what voir dire is?
Sure.
Sorry. Hold on. Go ahead.
Yes. Voir dire is the opportunity. I do a lot of work in the South, so sometimes I fall into voir dire.
Yeah, that sounds really Southern.
Exactly, and it's an opportunity for the lawyers to specifically ask jurors questions about their backgrounds and experiences that might be relevant to the case. They're not supposed to ask about anything they want to. They're supposed to ask about only things that might be relevant to people's ability to make a fair decision in a case. And both sides get a chance to question jurors, and at the end of the process, the both sides get to use what are called peremptory challenges, which means that they get to exclude people for basically no reasons, just because they don't think those people would be good for their case. And then they're also able to ask the judge, "Judge, I believe that one of these jurors has presented an unacceptable bias." And that is called asking for an exception for cause. And you ask the judge, "Judge, they've said they can't follow the law for this reason. Like I said before, they've said they have a limit on how much they can give no matter what the evidence says. And that's contrary to the law. That person should be excluded for cause. I shouldn't have to use one of my, for example, three peremptory challenges on that person because they've said they can't be fair." And that's how the process works.
Got it. And so when you are a jury consultant during this process, is this something that you sit with the lawyers while the process is going on?
Yes. And we've prepared ahead of time. We've given our lawyers a list of questions that we think they should go through that are going to identify not only the people they want to exclude for because they're not going to be good for our case, but also because how to identify that they might not be able to be there for cause.
Got it. David Zanner, thank you. We're going to flip it to the news. Please give us a call here if you've got a legal question. 312-591-7200.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away.
And there ain't no sunshine when there's a total eclipse coming
ain't
up tomorrow.
No sunshine when
I didn't buy
gone.
The glasses. I didn't take a Wheaties box. I didn't do any of those things. I'm an eclipse loser. Actually, I have to work. I have to go to court during that time, so I don't think I can see it anyway. Anyway, I'll see it on the news, I suppose. Give us a call here. We're taking legal questions, 981-7200. Text to that same number, 981-7200. We're talking with David Zahner, who is a jury consultant, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the Bill Cosby case. Now, that case came down, and this was the plaintiff who sued in Pennsylvania, who claims that she knew Cosby and that he gave her a drug and that he sexually assaulted her while she was out. And this happened approximately 12 years ago. The jury hung, and it looks like it's going to be retried. Not being in the courtroom, of course, you weren't there and you didn't see the whole thing go down. But were you surprised by that from what you know?
I was a little bit surprised. Usually in a criminal case involving allegations of sexual assault like that, and when there's so much pre-existing publicity, I thought it was going to be very hard for the jurors not to be aware that there were hundreds of claims of rape against Bill Cosby. But it looks like the defense at least got a couple of people on there who were unaware of these claims, and they focused on the one specific claim, and they didn't hear about all that other what we call pattern evidence. And because Bill Cosby is more well-known than most defendants, a lot of the things that jurors usually use in determining guilt or innocence in a criminal trial didn't go into place. And instead, they were thinking about, would Bill Cosby, this person I'm very familiar with, would he have committed that act? Not did the prosecution prove that the acts were committed.
A couple of things, and I wanted to explain briefly, because I get that question all the time. Why in the world wouldn't all of those other instances that other women said happen, why couldn't those have been brought in? Why couldn't they have paraded in all of those women who probably would have welcomed the opportunity to give evidence? And the law is just very interesting. The law wants you to focus on the particular instance, what happened on that day and at that time between those two parties, and that you're not going to be allowed to parade in all of the bad evidence against the person who's being sued or being prosecuted. In this case, it's being sued. So the law basically says those people don't get to be heard. Now, the judge did allow, I believe, at least one other person who said the same thing happened. And because it was so very similar to what this woman was alleging, the judge did let it in. But you're right. I figured if they had heard all of those other pieces of evidence, all those other women who say the same thing happened the same way, that would be much more compelling in a case like this. Now, going back to the issue of Bill Cosby himself, is there such a thing as celebrity gets a break in court?
Yeah, there definitely is a thing of where a celebrity gets a break in court. And that's because jurors are deciding cases under much different. I talked about schema earlier, about what factors their brain is using to make decisions. When they're dealing with a celebrity, they have a whole new set of schema, a whole new set of factors that they bring into play that they wouldn't normally bring in. This is especially true in criminal trials. Most jurors, innocent until proven guilty, unfortunately, is just not a truth in our legal system. About 70% of jurors, when they step in the door, assume that if the police has charged someone with a crime, they must have done something wrong, and so therefore, the DAC is kind of stacked against criminal defendants when they walk in the door. With celebrities, that's not the case. Celebrities do actually get a presumption of innocence when they walk in, just because jurors are thinking about them differently than they're thinking about the typical criminal defendant.
And that would that go for a civil case too, like a Taylor Swift?
It's a little bit different in civil cases because those pre-existing conceptions that people have about the people. Now, Taylor Swift, for example, it worked well for her because the way she acted in the courtroom was similar to her public persona. But in civil cases where there are celebrities have bad acts, like O.J. Simpson is a really good example. People had known about things and they brought those into play. It can work against them in a civil case.
Got it. We're going to take some calls, legal calls now. 981-7200. Looks like we have Amy from Downers Grove. Hi, Amy. Welcome to WGN. Do you have a legal question?
Hi. I do. My mother-in-law, actually my father-in-law passed away in March, and my mother-in-law is living by herself. And my sister-in-law is trying to move in with her. The question I have is if my mother-in-law passes, the home and the contents of the home goes to my husband, and then all the money assets is divided 50-50. If my sister-in-law is in the home, how do you go about getting her out of the home?
Well, you can do that. I mean, you'd have to go to court, go to the probate court, and have her removed. So, but as it stands, your father-in-law's death means that your mother-in-law can stay in there. Is that correct? And then she can have whoever she wants live with her, right? You have no
correct.
Question about that.
Okay. No.
So, but yes, when your mother-in-law dies, clearly, if the will states that the property goes to whomever, that's what has to happen. And if she refuses to move out, you can go into the probate court and get that kind of relief, almost like an eviction in the probate court. So it gets messy that way. And, you know, it may be better for the mother-in-law to have some sort of lease with her or some sort of contract with her. I take it you object to that, her moving in.
No, I don't object to it. I just wanted to know if she does move in, you know, and then when my mother-in-law passes, you know, where that goes from there. Because
yeah.
In her will, that's what it states.
Yeah. So it has to be, the will has to be followed, and she's going to be subject to whatever the will says. So good luck. Good luck.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Let's go. There's a couple of texts that I want to this is similar, another case having to do with estates, coming from the 269 area code. When a trustee has been told by the courts and a lawyer to give accountings and won't do it, can any legal action be taken against him? So a trustee, I take it this is in probate court, meaning the will has been probated, and he has to now give accountings to the court. And accountings are basically, what are the assets in the estate and what are the debts in the estate? And have you gathered all of the assets? Have you gotten all of the money from people who might have owed? Have you gathered all of the credit card bills and all the funeral expenses? And have you put them all together and have you done an accounting? Because you must pay all those bills and pay off those debts before any of the money or assets are distributed. So according to this text, the trustee is not doing his job. And in that case, you know, you probably, you know, you can hire a lawyer and go into that court and see if that trustee can be removed so you can get somebody in there who can do an efficient job of closing this estate. I hear all the time that executors and trustees do not do the right thing. They move slowly. And that's just a word of wisdom to people out there. When you select an executor or a trustee in your estate plan, and I don't do this kind of work, so I'm just talking generally, you really need to have somebody who's trustworthy, and you really need to have somebody who's good with numbers and who's responsible and good with keeping track of things. Because if you just give it to somebody who is a close relative, that might not be the best person to do it. And then it causes all kinds of delay and all kinds of problems and all kinds of stress to your family members. So choose wisely and think about who, you know, figure out what those tasks are that a trustee or an executor has to do and find out who might be the best person to do that. I want to go to the another text, 331 area code. I live in an apartment dwelling and I have COPD. Unknowingly, I was placed in a state-run housing apartment next to the smoking area outside my window. I smell smoke day and night. The management will do nothing. I was told to keep the windows closed and use my air conditioner, but that stinks because the smoke is also there and my breathing hoses get contaminated. What can I do? You know, I don't see anything in this that says that there is a rule against this. If there's a rule against smoking in that facility, then I think you need to put some pressure on the housing people to enforce the rules. If there's no rule there, you know, you might be at the whim of what goes on here. I mean, you could try to talk to the city about this being a nuisance and about the air being not clean and that it's hurting you and see if they will intervene. But generally speaking, if you're in an apartment where there's smoking allowed, you really are at the whim of the people who smoke there. I hate to say that because I'm not a fan of smoking and I don't like the smell myself. But to bring a lawsuit for nuisance against someone, you know, you're talking about a $50,000 to $100,000 lawsuit. Your best bet is probably just to move out. We are going to be taking more of your calls after the break. I'm Karen Conti. I'm here on WGN. Give us a call, 312-981-7200, 981-7200. Welcome back, Karen Conti here on WGN. You know, it's kind of interesting. We had two comedians, two fabulous comedians, die this weekend. Jerry Lewis, of course, at age 91, and Dick Gregory at 84. And I just have a fond memory of having met him in the Italian neighborhood and talking to him for a while. He's a very intense man. And I remember he knew I was a lawyer, and he told a joke that I saw quoted all over the place. He said, you know, segregation is not all that bad. Who ever heard of a collision where people in the back of a bus got hurt? I love that. I love that. Rest in peace, both comedians. We're here with David Zanner, and we're talking about trial consulting. And I wanted to ask you, from a legal standpoint, as you select jurors, you cannot, according to the law, discriminate based on race, meaning you can't say, I want African-American jurors or I don't. Do you think that's a good rule?
Yes, that's a very good rule. It is very important that our juries represent the communities that exist with them. If they don't, it's very hard for justice to be served either in civil or criminal cases.
But don't you do it anyway? I mean, let's look at it this way. I mean, an African-American person comes to the jury pool with a whole different set of attitudes about crime, about where they live, about their experiences and being discriminated against, about jobs, about whatever it is. And I feel the same way as a woman. I'm going to come to the pool with a whole different view of a case, perhaps in the area of discrimination, like let's just say the Taylor Swift case. You know, I would come to that jury really having sympathy for her, knowing what sometimes men do in the workplace, whereas maybe men wouldn't really understand that. Okay, so why wouldn't you be able to, as a lawyer or as you as a jury consultant, try to get people who are going to be more sympathetic to your client?
Yes, you do want to get people who are going to be more sympathetic to your client. And the way you do that is by asking them about experiences they may have had. And so, for example, with men in the Taylor Swift case, you would ask them, well, have you ever been discriminated against because of your gender in the workplace? And when people say no, you're developing a gender-based reason for why to eliminate them. Or have you ever felt that you've been you can also ask, have you ever felt that you've been unfairly accused of harassing someone in the workplace? And that would give you a very good reason to exclude them from a gender discrimination case. And that's the way you do it. You don't base your ideas on race. You base it on the experiences people have. Now, unfortunately, sometimes people with certain races, ethnicities, and genders have common experiences. And that's just because of the way society works. And therefore, it becomes a shorthand. It's a big mistake, though, for lawyers and for jury consultants like myself to look at people and say, oh, because that person is a woman, or because that person is an older white male, or that person is a Latino, they're all going to have the exact same experiences. You have to question them and find out if they've had the experiences that might make them not sympathetic to your clients. But to assume it is a big mistake, and one I've taken advantage of with many of my clients when the other side applies those kind of stereotypes unfairly.
Now, do jurors lie to either get on the jury because they want to serve, or do they lie to try to stay off?
Both. And when you are a lawyer, or in my case, when you can tell someone is lying or someone really wants to get on a jury, you're generally very wary of that person, because when people really want to do something, a lot of times it isn't because of the reasons that they're supposed to be doing it for. So you have to be very clear with your client. Look, this person really wants on this jury. We've got to be sure that the reason they want to get on is not something that's going to be problematic for our client. People lie probably more often to try and get off of juries, but we already know most people don't want to serve. And so, therefore, that's something that judges and everyone in the process is used to seeing.
Great. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about why you should want to serve on a jury, but I'm going to take this call. Dave, welcome to WGN. Do you have a legal question?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question following the discussion on the Bill Cosby and Taylor Swift cases.
Sure.
My wife was the victim of a sexual assault by a massage therapist. And we were wondering about the timing in terms of waiting for criminal charges to be filed versus filing a civil suit, or even when we should be reporting to the Illinois Department of Professional Regulation.
That's a good question. I'm very sorry to hear about this. That's very disturbing. Basically, you know, there's a couple of things. I would say that you should be talking to the prosecutor. Are they going to bring charges? Do you know that?
From what the detective has told us, she's waiting for the DA to, or the state's attorney to let her know when they plan to prosecute. But from my understanding, the detective was told that they do want to move forward.
Okay. So if that's an important thing for you, and I would imagine it is, to prosecute and put in jail somebody who does this, you don't want to bring a civil suit. And here's why. The prosecution doesn't want to put your wife up on the stand where her credibility is at issue. And the first question out of the mouth of the defense lawyer is, and you sued him for $1 million. You really want the money here, don't you? And that would be a horrific thing for your wife to sit and have asked of her. It would also, it may even prevent the prosecutor from bringing the case altogether, because it's such an impactful thing for a juror to know that there's a lawsuit pending. I have a case right now where there was an embezzlement of about $750,000, and my client wants to bring the lawsuit against the person who embezzled the money. But the prosecutor said, if you do that, I can't face the jury with the idea that there's a civil suit, because the jurors might say, well, this is all about money. This is not about who did the wrong thing and who should go to jail. So you're in a compromised position. So you have basically your statute of limitations is probably 2 years from the date it happened to bring a civil action. So you might have to, if it takes long time to bring this prosecution, you might have to take a choice. You know, either have the case be prosecuted or bring the civil lawsuit. But that's that you should talk to the prosecutor about that to make sure that that is exactly what, you know, he believes. Okay.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Good luck. Good luck. I hope that works out. Let's talk a little bit, Dave, about, we're talking jury selection, and I wanted to talk a little bit, just briefly, about this Jason Van Dyke case that everyone's talking about. This is the Laquan McDonald shooting. The police officer shot Laquan McDonald in the back 16 times. He's being charged with first-degree murder. The case may be moved to venue because of pretrial publicity. It may not be moved. What if you were representing this police officer and you were advocating for him, what kind of jurors would you want on this panel?
Yeah, and I've worked on several police brutality cases for different jurisdictions. And what you are looking for are people who are going to be understand the point of view of the officer. So, for example, anyone who's either been a law enforcement officer or thought about becoming a law enforcement officer, or has friends or family that are law enforcement officers. You also want people who are generally, not surprisingly, more conservative in their beliefs. I guarantee that when this case does go to trial, you're going to hear a lot of people asking about, okay, what news programs do you watch? What papers do you read? What websites do you visit? As using it as a to get an idea for both sides, who is more likely to have heard news and what kind of news they've heard about this. It's been a very big case with lots of publicity, but depending on what news outlets you've listened to, you've heard different versions of the case. And so that would be my expectations, that both sides will be asking those kinds of questions to identify the people they would want to knock off.
Got it. You know, one of the questions I have is when jurors deliberate, and you know, and when jurors get into a heated argument, and you see this occasionally where jurors are very polarized, and you can even see when I've tried cases where I wait for the verdict and I watch the jurors come out and they look angry, and some of them are sitting with each other and some of them are sitting with the other side, and you can tell they're not, and or you can even hear it from the jury room sometimes. You can't hear exactly what's going on, but you can hear the yelling and screaming going on, which is just not good. What is that a good thing for a verdict, to have that kind of heated discussion, or does that result in bad verdicts?
It doesn't so much result in bad verdicts. It results in really unhappy jurors, and a lot of times it ends up with a case that can't be settled. You much more prefer, and fortunately, most deliberations do not get to that point. It's much more the exception than the rule. Most people, by the time they get done with their jury service, they talk about what a great experience was. I've interviewed thousands of jurors after actual jury deliberations, and most of them say, this was one of the best experiences of my lives. I got to meet people I never would have met before, and we came together for a common goal of finding out what was the right thing that should be done. So that is the fighting in juries is not a good thing. And fortunately, it's a fairly rare occurrence.
I agree with you that jurors largely say their experience was excellent and was a look into something that they've never done before. And I would encourage everyone who's called to jury duty, don't blow it off because they're going to send a summons out to you to arrest you. It's one of your obligations as a citizen of this country. And it's something that you should, it's inconvenient to everyone. And we all appreciate when you serve, but it's something that you should do, and you probably will find that it's a good experience. David Zahner, thank you so much for being with us. Can you tell our listeners if you have where they can reach your Zahner trial consultant?
Yes, Zahner Trial Consulting. You can reach me at dave@zahnerjuries.com, and it's ZehnerJuries.com. Or just look in the web for Zahner Trial Consulting.
And you can always call me and I can give you Dave's number. My number at the office is 312-332-7800. It's been a pleasure. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN. It's 9 o'clock and it's time for the news sponsored by Pearl Mortgage, Roger Badish.